because I think there's really two ways that you can approach how to provide better programs and services to Canadians. You can either have governments tax and spend and borrow their way to pay for these programs on behalf of Canadians, whether you want the program or service or not, or you can leave more money in the pockets of Canadians to decide for themselves if they want programs and services and how they want to allocate their money.
Hello, welcome to Strictly Money, where your finance and prosperity meet. I'm Sejal Patel. Today, we are unpacking Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland's fourth federal budget. Now, this budget was really aimed at trying to win over millennials and Gen Z who are pretty disgruntled over higher living costs, especially higher housing costs. But this is coming at a time where productivity and the standard of living for Canadians has dropped. In fact, the former Bank of Canada Governor, David Dodge, was expecting this to be the worst budget he had seen since 1982. Was it? And is it moving us in the right direction when it comes to economic and personal prosperity? Well, to answer all of this and to unpack the numbers is Jake Fuss. Jake is the Director of Fiscal Studies at Fraser Institute. He regularly writes for the Globe and Mail, National Post, as well as the Toronto Star, and he joins me now. Hi, Jay. Thanks for coming on Strictly Money.
Thanks very much for having me back on.
So a lot of the details of the budget was actually leaked before the actual budget, Jake, which is, you know, often unusual. But the thing that at least I'm paying attention to is whether Canada is moving in the right direction, whether it comes to personal prosperity or economic prosperity. So maybe we can start with economic prosperity. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the main message that the budget sends is that we're kind of doubling down on this approach that we can kind of magically tax and spend our way to prosperity in Canada. That hasn't worked over the last 9 years or so. If we actually look at living standards measured by GDP per capita, for instance, that was actually lower for Canadians at the end of 2023 than it was 9 years ago in 2014. So we're really now just kind of continuing with the same approach where we're increasing government spending massively. Spending is going to be up about $77 billion higher than what the government forecasted last spring over the next 4 years. And we're also going to have a significant accumulation of debt, over $150 billion over the next 5 years. And ultimately, that burden is going to be passed on to the next generation of Canadians. So ultimately, you know, right now we're not seeing a whole lot of measures that are actually going to improve prosperity and living standards for Canadians. The capital gains tax hike, for instance, is just another instance where that's going to have a harmful effect to investment and productivity growth in Canada and ultimately to living standards and wages for Canadians too.
Yeah. And we're going to dive into all of that, Jake. I want to go back to the living standards because our Canadians' living standards has dropped, right? Are we near the lowest when it comes to G7? I know compared to the US, we're actually lower.
Yeah, so one of the challenges right now is that we've declined while other countries are increasing in terms of living standards. So we're actually falling behind a lot of these other advanced economies around the world, not only in the G7, but in the OECD largely. Countries like Ireland and Estonia actually have much faster growth in productivity and GDP per capita than we do. And countries like Estonia, for instance, are going to surpass us within the next 30 to 40 years in terms of living standards, whereas they were at a significantly below Canada's level. Only, you know, 20 years ago, for instance. And at the same time, the OECD is projecting that Canada is going to have the lowest growth of any advanced economy over the next 10 to 40 years in terms of GDP per capita. So there's a lot of troubling signs. And unfortunately, this budget is probably going to make that problem even worse.
Can we talk a little bit about productivity, Jake? Because I'm not sure the average Canadian actually understands what that means. And the fact that our productivity has dropped, the impact that that actually has on their personal situation. So can you walk us through that?
Sure. So what we mean by productivity is essentially the output in the economy per hour worked. So when you become more productive, there's actually a direct linkage towards companies that become more productive and actually end up paying higher wages to their employees over time. So there's a huge linkage there in terms of living standards and productivity in Canada. Right now, we have weak productivity growth, or in some cases, declining productivity growth. And ultimately, that means that Canadians are not better off than they otherwise would be. So it's a huge problem right now in Canada. A huge connect to that too is that we're seeing collapsing business investment, which is all ultimately critical to actually improving that productivity growth. And right now what we're seeing is declining investment, whereas the United States, for instance, actually has increasing business investment and has much higher productivity growth than us.
Right. So the productivity part, if we want to improve it, part of it is also regulations, isn't it? I think we seem to have a lot of red tape. Things move very, very slow in Canada. So that's probably one aspect. And like you said, the business investment, there isn't a lot of incentive for businesses to invest in Canada right now.
Well, and that's the main issue. I mean, like you said, the regulatory red tape is very high in Canada right now. We also have an uncompetitive tax environment too. So it's more attractive to actually invest your capital in other countries beyond Canada, not only the United States, but other countries in Europe and Asia, for instance, to have lower tax rates than us. So we should actually be looking for solutions to address the productivity crisis. So some of those things might be lowering tax rates or maybe removing barriers in interprovincial trade in Canada, getting rid of regulations that don't make sense and that are harmful as well. But instead, we're actually increasing regulations, we're increasing taxes, and we're doing nothing about interprovincial trade barriers right now in Canada.
Yeah. You know, I always say, first of all, you can't tax your way to prosperity. We know that doesn't work. And this idea of just moving money around doesn't work. I think most Canadians would understand that if we make the pool bigger, so everyone becomes more prosperous. Of course, you have to have, you know, a little bit of a level playing field, but that's actually the biggest concern right now, isn't it? That's not happening. We're not growing the pool. We're just moving money.
Exactly. I mean, and we're seeing that in the living standards for Canadians in terms of that those GDP per capita numbers right now. We're not able to actually just tax and spend our way to prosperity. We have to actually do things that grow the economy in a tangible way that's meaningful as well. And right now we really have a stagnant economy. You know, we also have relatively high inflation, which means your purchasing power is decreasing as well over time. We also have housing issues in Canada. So there's a lot of challenges right now on the cost of living and affordability for Canadians. And ultimately, this approach that we're taking and provinces are taking it too, it's not just the federal government. They're really just trying to increase taxes and increase spending to get us to more prosperity. So far, that has not paid off, and it's unlikely to do so in the future either.
Jake, I want to go back to the federal debt. So what I have here, and correct me if I'm wrong, $53 billion in new spending, projected debt to GDP around 42%, and Friedland insists that she's being fiscally responsible.
Well, they've certainly used that rhetoric in terms of fiscal responsibility, and it's a line that they've used the last number of years. But what we're seeing is with every fiscal update or every budget that comes out, spending always goes up higher than what they had previously suggested it was going to be. So, you know, the number that I cited before, you know, spending is going to be up $77 billion over the next 4 years above what the government forecasted last year. So that's just kind of a metric over the next 4 years. And they've done that time and time again. And at the same time, debt has been increasing. So the government actually benefited from higher than expected revenue in their budget now over the next number of years, because they have slightly higher than expected economic growth. And they're also forecasting about $19 billion from this capital gains tax hike. But instead of using that money to reduce the deficits, what they're doing is just increasing spending and offsetting any of the gains they get from revenue. That's not a fiscally responsible approach. A fiscally responsible approach would be not passing the burden of debt onto another generation of Canadians. And ultimately, that's what they continue to do right now.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people would say, Jake, well, we need more program spending. And I'll give you the example, you know, the National School Food Program. I think most people would agree, we don't want children to be starving, you know, and coming to school. The argument, though, that I make is that you're not fixing the problem by handing them money. I think most families would rather see sustainable living costs, so they're saving, and so they can decide what that looks like, and they can actually feed their children rather than, you know, rely on the government. And this is what concerns me, is that there's this cycle, you know, the vicious cycle of just, here, we're just going to keep handing you money, so you become addicted to this.
Well, and I think that's right, because I think there's really two ways that you can approach how to provide better programs and services to Canadians. You can can either have governments tax and spend and borrow their way to pay for these programs on behalf of Canadians, whether you want the program or service or not, or you can leave more money in the pockets of Canadians to decide for themselves if they want programs and services and how they want to allocate their money. But right now, we're really choosing the former approach rather than the latter. And ultimately, that is a philosophy that it's not really paying off for us in terms of addressing, you know, how do we improve living standards for Canadians? How do we let them decide for themselves how to improve our quality of life in Canada? And so far, this plan has really not worked.
I want to go back to the debt too. What is it? The actual debt is it 1.5 trillion? I'm forgetting. I don't have that number here. But this is what concerns me, because the interest in servicing that debt, the money that's going towards it, if I'm correct, Jake, it's going to be around $60 billion, which is actually more. We're spending more on interest payments than we are actually going towards our healthcare, if I'm right. This is what I've read. Is that right?
That's correct. So in 2024, the government's expecting to spend about $54 billion on debt interest payments. That's higher than what we spend on the Canada Health Transfer, which is the money that the federal government sends to the provinces for their healthcare. They're spending about $52 billion on that. So we're spending $2 billion more on debt interest payments than we are on the healthcare transfers. And if you actually look at the budget as well, you'll notice that the GST, or goods and services tax revenue, is exactly equivalent to the amount that we're paying in debt interest payments. So in other words, all of the money that we're spent or giving to the government in terms of goods and services tax is going straight to debt interest payments at $54 billion this year. And that number is expected to increase over the next number of years. We're going to surpass $60 billion within the next 5 years on debt interest payments.
That is a lot of hospitals. That's a lot of schools. That's a lot of money that could be used somewhere else. Jake, before we go to a commercial break, I do want to get your thoughts on this. There is a difference between spending and investing, right? Where would you like spending to happen versus investing?
Yes. So this is a great question. Well, ultimately, governments usually phrase a lot of spending as investments. Now, there are certain elements of spending that can be better than others. So for instance, investing in infrastructure can actually lead to higher economic growth. So that's one area that's more beneficial than other areas. A lot of spending on just straight up programs, for instance, isn't necessarily an investment. It's more of just a cost, for instance. The other thing too is, you know, spending on things like national defense. Well, that's a core function of the federal government, so that might actually have some benefits to it as well. But there is this whole notion right now from governments that every source of spending is really an investment in Canadians, but that's not the case. A lot of it is just indebting Canadians and not necessarily leading to the boost in economic growth that we actually
have. And I say that to folks, right? You know the difference, because there is a difference between spending and investing. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break and hear from our sponsors, BMO ETFs, and we'll be right back.
Are you looking to enhance the level of cash flow from your investments? BMO ETFs has you covered with their Coverage Call ETFs. These ETFs generate cash flow from two sources, the dividend yield from the underlying securities and the premium generated from selling the call options. BMO Covered Call ETFs strike a balance between generating cash flow and participating in the growth of rising markets with your experienced portfolio management team and effective strategy with over 10 years of history. BMO ETFs is the largest covered call ETF provider in Canada, covering 13 covered call ETFs across a range of strategies across regions, countries, and sectors. Visit BMOETFs.com to learn more. Please read the ETF facts or prospectus of the BMO ETFs before investing.
Welcome back. I'm here with Jake Fuss of Fraser Institute. Jake, one of the things that I was paying attention to in the budget was what they were offering small and medium-sized businesses. And the reason is they employ at least two-thirds of the Canadians. So, you know, in my mind, we need to be supportive. And that leads to, again, as we've talked about, productivity. But there didn't seem to be a lot. Anything stand out for you?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there wasn't a whole lot in this budget to help small and medium businesses or entrepreneurs, which is something that we really need in Canada to actually improve that productivity and economic growth. I think the capital gains tax hike that we saw is not going to be beneficial for small businesses or for investors in Canada as well. So I think that's going to be a huge deterrent to investment in Canada. We're probably going to see a lot of capital go to other countries instead of Canada. Or what we'll see is investors hold on to assets in the hopes that maybe a future government gets rid of the capital gains inclusion rate going up to 66%. So I think it's going to be detrimental for the Canadian economy in terms of that tax change.
Yeah, let's talk about the capital gains inclusion rate for people who may not know. So this change is going to be coming on how capital gains are taxed. Right now, it's a 50% inclusion rate. That is going up to two-thirds, so 66.6% on capital gains above $250,000. So, you know, when I saw this, Jake, it, in one way, I thought from a personal standpoint, I could kind of see it. And the reason I say that, and feel free to disagree with me, but the reason I felt that way is if you're getting taxed on, you know, your second home or your cottage or something like that, you're not really contributing to the economy. It's not like you're employing people. So in a way, I could kind of see that. But what frustrated me was the capital gains inclusion tax for corporations.
Yeah, well, I think ultimately the issue is right now when we are increasing this inclusion rate, ultimately, like we're in a time where we need more private and business investment in the Canadian economy. So this just acts as another disincentive for people to invest in the Canadian economy. And the other thing that's kind of missed in this discussion too is a lot of people point to, you know, capital gains taxes just being something for the wealthy, for instance. That's not actually the case because a lot of capital gains are one-time amounts that people get selling their small business, for instance. And when you actually claim that capital gains, it makes your income look higher in a specific year than it actually would. And what my colleagues found is that less than half of the capital gains taxes are paid by people with normal year-over-year incomes above $150,000. So in other words, there's a lot of people that aren't necessarily high income that would actually pay these capital gains taxes. And I think that's something that's really missing from this discussion too.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I keep hearing, oh, we didn't get a wealth tax. You know, we didn't, everyone was expecting a wealth tax and we didn't get it. And I'm like, well, we actually kind of did. it's just created a different way. But two, it's being positioned as a wealth tax when really it's affecting productivity in investment.
Yes. And I mean, there was a lot of signals before the budget that there might be something like a wealth tax that was tried in other countries, like in Europe. France actually had a wealth tax for many years. They ended up abandoning the tax because they found that it was more economically damaging to keep the tax around than it was to actually generate revenue from that wealth tax. And many other countries in Europe have followed the same example, like Austria and Germany, for instance. But ultimately, this capital gains inclusion rate hike was actually the substitute that they had for the wealth tax that was kind of signaled before the budget. But we know that this is going to have similar effects for capital outflows from Canada, especially at a time when we're facing this investment and productivity crisis. It's just going to make the issue even worse and ultimately going to affect economic growth in a harmful manner.
Yeah. And wealth tax is a double tax. I mean, you're getting taxed on your income and then you're getting taxed again. So I'm glad they didn't go that far, but this is just a different way of, I guess, doing it. Jake, let's talk about the personal prosperity side, in particular, tackling home affordability, because this is where, you know, they are trying to sway over the millennials and the Gen Zs, you know, who are disgruntled because they can't afford a home. Did they do a good job?
Well, I would say the positive and the silver lining is that they are paying attention to this issue where it maybe didn't get as much attention in the past. The issue, though, is really this is a supply side issue that we need to address. And some of the mechanisms that the federal government was implementing will actually likely stimulate more demand in the housing market, which means that you push up prices even further. So some of the measures that I'm talking about here are like the 30-year amortization period for first-time homebuyers or increasing the withdrawal limit in your RRSP for the home buyers plan. Those will actually likely incentivize more demand in the market and push up prices, like I said. It's similar to also, you know, some of the measures that they've taken in the past, like the first home savings account. It's a well-intentioned policy, and I understand why they're doing a policy like that. But it's actually more beneficial than a TFSA and an RRSP. So a lot of housing or a lot of assets for people are likely going to be invested further into the housing market, which again means that housing demand is going to go up. And ultimately, affordability could actually become worse if house prices are increasing faster than people's incomes. And that's what really matters here. It's purchasing power. It's not necessarily about having an extra, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 here or there to go towards housing. If your house prices are going up by $30,000 and your income's only going up by $20,000, for instance, that means that you're actually worse off than you were before in terms of affordability.
What I don't like about this, Jake, in terms of sort of the 30-year amortization in the RSP, the first home buyer's plan, is that it's sending the wrong signal. And I don't know if they realize this, that what you're basically saying to someone is, hey, you know what? Your retirement doesn't really matter. you can pull your money out and focus on buying a home. And I understand why homes are important, but you really do need a balance. You know, if you look at the statistics, so many people are not even saving for a 25, 30-year retirement. And if you're telling them that they can pull out $60,000 of their, you know, of their RSP, which my understanding is a lot of people don't even have that much in their RSP. So the point is kind of mute. You know, they probably wouldn't even be able to pull that much money out because they don't have it in the first place. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, ultimately, you know, just because you increase it to $60,000 as a withdrawal limit doesn't necessarily mean people have that amount of money that they can put towards it. And I think the larger issue too is, you know, instead of kind of focusing on these demand mechanisms like RRSPs or 30-year amortization periods, the entire focus of the federal government and provinces and municipalities in Canada should be just on focusing on the supply mechanisms right now. You know, the federal government announced, you know, their plan to build significantly more homes. But I'm ultimately skeptical that we're going to be able to double the amount of housing that we're building right now based on our current trajectories. You know, housing starts haven't really increased dramatically over the last number of years. And there's still a lot of impediments in the way in terms of permit wait times to get houses built. Zoning laws are still an issue in a lot of municipalities. And ultimately, you know, we do need to focus on increasing supply quite dramatically, especially with how fast the population is going to grow in Canada.
I'm glad you made that point because I was listening to an interview this morning and they were saying just the zoning, you know, to try to get this the land to build on. I think, if I'm correct, it takes about 7 or 8 years in Canada and it only takes about 2 or 3 in the U.S. So that's a huge, huge issue. So unless I think they fix that, we're going to keep banging our head against the wall when it comes to supply.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of regulatory red tape at the provincial and municipal level right now in Canada, which is really the primary jurisdiction responsible for housing. So places like Toronto and Vancouver take several years to get permits to build homes, which slows down the process, decreases the supply available on the market, increases the housing prices. At the same time, you also have like high developer fees that are tacked on by municipalities, provinces. That increases the cost of homes as well. And then you have other mechanisms too, like zoning laws being restrictive in terms of what can be built and where it can be built, that ultimately is going to suppress the supply of housing as well, which again pushes up prices and makes it less affordable for Canadians. So that's a particularly acute problem in many municipalities like Vancouver, Toronto.
Jake, what would you have liked to see in the budget?
I would have liked to see more of a focus on tax competitiveness in Canada, also ways that we can tangibly improve productivity as well. So things like reducing interprovincial trade barriers in Canada. So having some leadership from the federal government, working with provinces to actually drop those barriers. That's a really easy way for us to actually increase economic growth and living standards for Canadians. I would have also liked to see some focus on regulatory environment in Canada. Right now, we're just continuing to increase regulations rather than having a review of what makes sense. And ultimately, are we getting in the way of businesses and people from actually improving their output and productivity over time? So I think there was a lot of missing elements in this budget. We're increasing taxes, even though we're already uncompetitive. So how can we actually boost productivity and growth rather than just doubling down on the status quo that hasn't worked thus far?
Let me ask you this then. Do you think any government, whether it's Liberal or, you know, if the Conservatives come in, can they afford to cut taxes? I feel like we need it, frankly. That's my personal opinion, but I'm wondering if it would be a hard sell to do it.
Well, I think ultimately they actually can do this. I mean, we had a study recently where we pointed out that you could actually cut personal income taxes and make it so that nearly all Canadians would face a marginal tax rate of about 15%. And then the highest income earners in Canada would pay a tax rate of about 29%. And how you would pay for this would be a modest reduction in government spending, but also removing a lot of tax credits in Canada that are actually not beneficial to the economy. So you could actually do this in a revenue neutral way over time, is cutting taxes while also getting rid of a lot of tax credits. And just having a small, modest reduction in government spending too.
Okay. Jake, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, before I let you go, you don't know about this, but I always ask my guests some personal financial questions. They're not gotcha questions, but I like to try to humanize finance. So there are three rapid fire questions. Are you ready to play?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay. What is the best financial advice you've ever received?
Oh, that's a good question. I think ultimately, starting to get into RSPs from a young age, that's been a big thing for me, starting to think about retirement and investing from a young age too. Too many Canadians kind of put this off for a long time. They don't start thinking about retirement or investing really until they get in their 30s, 40s, sometimes even 50s. So I think for me, something that was really instilled in me was getting into investing and planning for retirement from a younger age.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because I don't think people realize how powerful the power of compounding is, right? You can put away a little bit of money, but when you start early, it snowballs rather than waiting longer, because then you have to put in a lot more money to get to that same level. So that's a good piece of advice. What is the worst financial advice you've received?
Oh, that's a good question. I think a lot of people don't necessarily pay attention to their portfolios in terms of investment as well. So a lot of people will just kind of put money into a mutual fund that their friend heard about or something like that. And for me, I think it's actually important to kind of do your own individual research. Yes, you want to listen to multiple different voices, but you also want to do a portfolio that matches what works for you, and also have a budget in mind for yourself. I think there's far too few people that actually budget their money and actually actively look at their portfolios on a regular basis too.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Investing is personal, right? You can't take your friend's advice because it might not make sense for yours. Okay, last one. If you could enact a law that would help people with their financial well-being, what would it be?
I think for me, it's actually about getting curriculum at a young age in our education system about personal financial literacy. I think there's, some people have great parents like myself that taught me from a young age about financial literacy and how to budget and how to spend your money and how to save. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't necessarily have those circumstances where they're taught from a young age about personal financial literacy. So I think there could be a mechanism in, educational systems from junior high or high school to start teaching a lot of these. And I know it already happens a little bit in Ontario, for instance, but I think even from a younger age and a more advanced curriculum would be very beneficial for people so they can understand how to, do tax planning, how they can understand how to budget, how to save and how to invest.
I have to agree with that. It's a life essential skill, and one that's probably going to carry people further than learning about trigonometry or something like that, right? Not that I'm saying that it's not important, but when you think about both, one's going to probably play a bigger role in someone's life. Thank you again, Jake. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much. I appreciate having me on.
Well, that wraps up this edition of Strictly Money. If you have thoughts about the budget, drop them in the comments below if you're on YouTube, or connect with me on LinkedIn and let me know. And don't forget to catch previous episodes and subscribe. I'll see you back here next week. Until then, stay well, stay wise, and stay wealthy.